ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If this thing is built, it will be a miracle to behold.
One of science's biggest promises.
It would be like the Wright brothers moment.
Governments, spies, billion-dollar investments, and scientific rivalries.
The control that's required is rivaled only by what God did in creating the universe.
Will quantum computers change everything? I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Quantum computing has spent years sounding like the kind of thing that belongs in a science fiction paperback wedged between time travel and sentient toasters. But all of a sudden, the biggest names in tech are treating it like the next great industrial arms race. Google, Microsoft, IBM, they are all chasing breakthroughs that could transform everything from medicine to finance. Meanwhile, cybersecurity experts are warning that those same machines could one day unravel the encryption protecting our bank accounts, our private messages, and our government secrets. The very technology promising extraordinary discoveries could also force us to rebuild much of the digital world from the ground up. So are we finally on the verge of the quantum future we've been promised? And are we actually ready for what comes next? My name is Rae Johnston, and welcome to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. And now joining me to unpack some of the biggest stories in quantum right now and why they matter is Justin Hendry, editor at innovationoz.com. Welcome back, Justin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Jacinta Bowler, science reporter and host of the new Science Friction series, Dead or Alive. Welcome, Jacinta. Now, the quantum computing race is heating up. We've got the world's biggest tech companies betting billions that they will build the computer that changes everything. Jacinta, what exactly is a quantum computer?
So I think people think that they know how a computer works, but I really think that if you tried to think about it too hard, it would also kind of fall flat. So computers, to start with, if you pull them back to their very, very basic components, is a system that uses electricity in most cases to be able to pass information. So you've got your ons and your offs, and that's how the information goes from one place to another. A quantum computer does something similar, except instead of having on and off, it also has this other state where it can be in multiple states at once. So it uses the power of quantum and the weirdness of quantum to be able to be better and be able to do problems, specific problems, faster. Did that work? Does that explain it? I don't know.
I've often heard the analogy. It's like, say, in a regular computing system, which is binary using zeros or ones, if you took that and put the zero and the one on either side of a coin and flipped the coin, but it just stayed flipping in the air forever. That's a way that I've heard some people explain it. Does that marry with your understanding?
We, in the series, actually, we use the term, it's like going from a 2D sketch to a sculpture. Like you actually, it's so much more than that. You end up with all of these different positions. But that's not really the important bit. The important bit is that quantum computers are able to do certain tasks extremely well. And so scientists have been trying to get to them for 30 years, trying to produce these quantum computers so that they can actually use this weird quantum technology to be able to, do better equations or, make new medicines or break the internet, depending on what you feel like doing at the time.
Now, in my 15 years of reporting on quantum computing, the amount of headlines that I have written that say things along the lines of, Australian scientists have just made an extraordinary breakthrough in quantum computing, there's always a little minute step when you look at it. At the moment, though, there's a lot of noise. Has the race to build quantum computers actually accelerated dramatically, or are they just being louder about it than usual, Justin?
I would say the race has definitely accelerated. Like you, I've been covering the space for some time, and yes, there's a liberal use of breakthrough in everything that comes through. So you see breakthroughs all the time, and trying to distill what that means is a job in itself, really, especially if you don't cover it full time. So, but that said, I would say it's definitely accelerated. I think we've seen a lot of companies ramping up, a lot of major tech companies ramping up, a lot of sort of challenger companies ramping up and showing what they've been doing over the last, particularly the last sort of 5 years. And we've also seen some moves, you know, by government. So the US government has made basically a directive recently, basically saying that, you know, we want to be the first country in the world to build a quantum computer. So that's something that's not really happened before. And it's quite a momentous move, I think, by a government to say, like, basically laying a, you know, a flag in the ground and saying we want to be the first in this space, in the same sort of way that we've seen with AI, really, and the sort of race to build the best system between the US and China. So it very much, I think, has accelerated in recent years, especially.
Google is one company in particular that's been quite loud about its achievements. Justin, take me through their latest breakthrough.
I thought I'd escape the technical questions after the first one. But yes, this is, look, it's very interesting. I think this was about 18 months ago, they released a chip called Willow, basically. And then 6 months ago, they released a new algorithm, and basically they claim that error correction through that combination is just amazing. And I think that chip was about 100 qubits, which is, you know, I think much greater than anything else we've seen elsewhere, at least that's been, I guess, publicized. And yeah, so in October last year, it upped its game and was able to do things that would have taken, I think, years to do in a matter of seconds or minutes. So, you know, the time frame to do this is accelerating all the time. The error correction, the ability for them to sort of basically workshop the errors as they come up is rapidly changing as well. We've got other companies that are also making breakthroughs, I guess, in this space regularly. But yeah, Google has done more recently is pretty impressive. Yeah. Mm.
So when we're mentioning qubits as well, so a regular computing system will use bits, and qubits is what's used by quantum computers, the little quantum bits. Looking at what Google's doing, Jacinta, how does Microsoft's approach differ to that? Are they doing something that's kind of within that realm or something completely different?
Yeah, so Microsoft is a bit of a complicated one. They have had some controversies in the past few years. So there's a lot of different companies that are in this race that are trying to build quantum computers. And quantum computers are interesting in that there hasn't really been one system that's been locked into. So your big tech companies, they use one version of this, but like a lot of the Australian companies use silicon instead. So depending on who you're talking to, you kind of have these different technologies that are being used, all trying to, you know, again, think about this quantum weirdness and trying to harness this quantum weirdness in a way that actually makes sense. But Microsoft had come out a couple of years ago and basically had this really big announcement saying that they'd done something that was incredibly impressive at the time. But it actually came to pass that they hadn't managed to do it. And there was a lot of skepticism in the field. And there's been recent announcements that this has happened again. So there is lots of different companies that are in this space. Google is one of them, Microsoft's one of them, IBM is another one that's doing quite a lot of work. And then you've got your startups as well. So you've got Psi Quantum is one that, you know, they're trying to build a quantum computer in Queensland. Like, there's lots of weird things happening, and there's a lot of money coming in from Silicon Valley and from tech startups to be able to, well, try and be the first, I guess.
It is curious the amount of cynicism that we have towards the claims coming out of these companies. I feel like seeing overinflated claims of what generative AI is capable of has kind of primed us to look at quantum with a little bit of skepticism. We're looking for actual evidence, actual proof here. Is there someone that we can rely on in this space? Is there a clear front runner in the quantum race, or is everyone just kind of working on different pieces of the puzzle here?
That is such a good question. almost everybody who we spoke to for the series had some company that they have joined or started or are now the CEO of. Almost everybody had this, you know, invested interest in making the technology seem like it was legit. And it's not to say that it's not. I think that quantum computers will probably happen. There's been a lot of work in the last few years and they are getting closer. But it is difficult to talk to somebody that you actually think is not thinking about their shareholders before they're thinking about the science. Saying that, though, Google a couple of years ago was able to do something called quantum supremacy. So that's when they were able to do something that a classical computer couldn't do. There was a big fight. IBM disagreed. So I guess that's still a problem there. But there in the last few years, yeah, Google's still doing quite well. PsiQuantum is another one that when you speak to researchers, they say that they're, you know, they're doing quite well. But they also don't tell you much about what's happening in their actual computer. They haven't released any papers. They've been quite quiet about their information. So I don't know. Watch this space. Once a quantum computer comes out, everyone's going to know about it.
What's your perspective on that, Justin?
Not as I understand it, there's no clear front runner. I mean, there's certainly companies like IBM, I think, have been widely recognized to be one of the leaders in the space. And I think even today, I think they put out in an investor call, they put out a statement about 2029 is when they were working towards as a timeline. So, and PsiQuantum was mentioned before, they for a long time were saying 2027, now they're saying 2030. So these timelines are changing and shifting all the time. It's very hard to work out where they are. I mean, you know, as we mentioned before basically, there's a lot of, secrets around the technology, and no one wants to give away too much to, I guess, remove their advantage, really. So, yeah.
So do we have any real way to know if we are getting meaningfully closer to having quantum computers? You know, I rely on research coming out of institutions, coming out of universities, but if it's being developed privately within business, it kind of puts the blinds down, doesn't it? We don't really get to peek and see if it's real, if it really is just around the corner. It makes it tricky.
Yeah, maybe the closest thing, I mean, that I see day to day are things as simple as, you know, Nature reports, peer-reviewed research that kind of gives an idea of where companies are going and what they've been able to achieve. That's probably the clearest cut for an outsider looking in, like a journalist. I'm not a quantum physicist. So it does make it difficult to assess claims, but I guess that's probably one of the clearest way that companies can get their what they're doing out there, and they do regularly release those reports as well. So yeah, that's probably one of the best ways, I would say.
Jacinta, as someone who no doubt has had to disseminate those papers and work out fact from fiction, have you been able to ascertain if we are meaningfully closer to having quantum computing?
We are definitely meaningfully closer. We have done a lot of history in the series to try and kind of think about how we have come from kind of this idea, this concept back in the 90s when everyone started realizing this could be something big to now. And there were so many problems in the early 2000s. It's wild to think about how far away they were, but still pushing for this. This is something that, you know, people like Michelle Simmons have been working on for their entire careers. Now, we are definitely closer now than what we were when she started doing this in the early 2000s. Like 100% we are closer. And I do think that we are close, especially because there are multiple tech companies that are coming in and kind of saying, this is the date. Saying that, though, there have been what we need with a quantum computer for it to actually be useful is things like algorithms and things that can be actually used on it. And we need to know that they can be used on the quantum computer. So it's not just building the hardware. It's not just getting those qubits in there. It's also about ensuring that the software does actually work on this and that it can work on certain things. And even when we do that, it's not necessarily going to change everything. It's going to change certain things. And AI is actually taking over quite a few of the things that quantum even, you know, 10 years ago, it was thought that quantum would be able to do. So hope they get it soon or they might be in trouble.
So say we've got quantum computing. Say it's widely released tomorrow. It's available to everyone. What industries are likely to actually benefit from this technology being a reality, Justin?
I think the clearest one that I see all the time is pharmaceuticals. So the development of new drugs, new therapies, potentially solving some of those challenges that we have around certain diseases. I don't want to go as far as saying it is a cure to cancer, but you know, that's the kind of thing that people are looking at using these computers to move the needle forward, I guess, to use a bad pun. But you know, it could be anything else. It could be finance, in banking systems. It could be energy, how we use electricity. I think we've mentioned on the show before, climate change is another area where you could potentially improve the modeling, although there is sort of supercomputers that can do that now. So there are a whole bunch of areas, but I think pharmaceuticals is the one that I always come back to just because of, you know, what that could potentially mean to people's lives. Yeah.
I'll add one more thing there is, so Shor's algorithm, one of the biggest algorithms, it was back in, I think the late 90s, 1994 was when they brought it out. That is an algorithm that deals with factorization, and factorization is what we use for our security on the internet. So another thing, and one of the reasons why governments are so invested in this and have been for such a long time, is because if they are able to use a quantum computer to be able to crack factorization, you can break the entirety of our encryption services, particularly on things like the internet.
Fantastic news. Thanks, Jacinta.
So, yeah, that's a big one.
You are listening to Download the Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you. And the internet security has a quantum-sized expiry date. The race is on to replace the encryption protecting our digital lives before someone else can break it. Justin, do you want to have a crack at explaining how today's encryption keeps our data safe? Or do you want me to throw that to Jacinta?
I mean, I can have a crack. I mean, I might not get it right. But look, for a want of a better term, I like to think of it as sort of scrambling data. So where you have data that goes, it might require an encryption key, but basically that gets scrambled through REST and in transit and, you know, in use as well. So basically text that you have on your computer can't be read by another actor, whether that's a bad actor or not. So it's a fundamental building block of, you know, the internet, for instance, and you know, many people would be familiar with all sorts of encrypted apps that we use. So this is a fundamental tool, security mechanism to protect the infrastructure we rely on each day, pretty much.
And Jacinta, you touched on it earlier, but why does quantum computing, why is it creating a cybersecurity problem? Why is it going to end all of the safety that we've built on the internet?
Yeah. So the way that factorization works, now I'm going to be really simple here because it is very complicated. But so factorization basically is, so when you multiply two numbers together, you know, 7 times 11, for example, 77, if you then try and find the factors of 77, that would be 7 and 11. So you can work that out relatively easily. Factorization is this, and it happens with really, really big numbers. And so you kind of have these two numbers, they get added together. That's not the hard part. The hard part is being able to work out what those two numbers were that actually made this giant number. And so the giant number is what goes between the two groups. And then if you've got these two groups, then you can say, okay, well, I have one number, you've got the other number, we can work that out. It breaks because quantum computers can do this factorization. Because of the way you've got not just two states, you've got multiple states, it does it significantly faster than a regular computer. Regular computers can't break this, but quantum computers can. So the idea is that it would, yeah, change the way that we have the internet. And there are ways of fixing this, but none of them are perfect.
Oh, great. Look, I've heard of this looming date. I'd love to get your perspective, Jacinta, on how far away this date is and what it actually means. Q Day. Why should we be worried about Q Day?
I love how ominous it is. So Q-Day is the day when a quantum computer could break factorization and break our encryption. And depending on who you ask, it's either really soon or never. And that's basically how it works in quantum computing. It's always very soon or never.
Or both at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. Both at the same time. So that's what Q-Day is. And governments have actually started to do things about this, right? So the US government, I believe, is changing over, in the process of changing over its encryption to what's called quantum safe encryption. The Australian government has asked people to change it over from one to the other. So they want everybody to do that by the end of, they want people to have systems in place to be able to start the process by the end of this year. I don't think anyone's going to be doing that. But potentially the worry is that if you don't, people could take all that sweet, sweet data that's currently encrypted, hold on to it, and then de-encrypt it when a quantum computer is available.
And that's the post-quantum cryptography that you hear about. So they're holding on to it and then decrypting it later. Is that what that is?
Yeah, so post-quantum cryptography is when you do a encryption that can't be broken by quantum computers.
Ah, right.
Now, that's a funny thing, isn't it? Because we don't have quantum computers. And I feel like quantum computers are going to give it a red hot go once it happens. But, you know, they're not based on factorization, so they don't have to worry about that particular problem.
When this change happens, when all of these industries and governments make this transition, is the everyday person just existing with technology going to even notice that this has happened? Are we going to have to do something, do you think?
I mean, I hope not. As someone who's not involved in computers at all, outside of writing about them, but it's broadly going to happen in the background, I think. It's the kind of thing you won't notice. If you work in that space, if you work at a major corporate, if you work at a government agency, absolutely. If you're on a board, absolutely, you're going to be worrying about that. Even now, about the potential for those types of that type of encrypted data to be stolen and potentially used down the line. So for the everyday person, probably not, but for people in leadership positions, absolutely.
So Jacinta, should we be worried about Q-Day as normies?
I think so, yes. So even if we transfer over to quantum safe encryption, it potentially could make the internet a little bit slower because factorization is very fast. So depending on what new encryption you end up with, it might be slightly worse than what we've currently got, which I mean is not a great sell for quantum computers, is it? It's like, oh, it'll make your life slightly bad. will we need to be worried about quantum Q-Day? I think yes, in the same way that you need to be worried about like making sure you change your passwords and be worried about regular amounts of data leaks. Like, this is something that we all should be worried about, but are probably less worried about than we should be. In the same way, I think Q-Day is one of those things where be aware of it, know that this is happening. If things are sorted, it shouldn't be an issue and that we should just continue as is. But there are potentials that, things like hospital details, or there's lots of ways that it could be a problem if a bad actor was decided to do this.
Justin, where does Australia fit in the global quantum race right now?
Well, believe it or not, we are actually widely considered a front runner, a leader in this space. Basically, we have a vibrant sector here, particularly in New South Wales. There's a bunch of companies doing really amazing things. I think I mentioned them before, Dirac and Silicon Quantum Computing, who are sort of came out of the UNSW, the University of New South Wales. And they punch above their weight, really. I mean, they're involved in benchmarking initiatives in the States, involved with the Defense Innovation Agency over there, DARPA as well. The only two companies outside of the US who are actually involved in that program. So, I think that's an amazing feat for a country like Australia, with this much smaller population than the US and not as large a technology sector, generally speaking. So, so those are two amazing companies. There's others as well. There's Quantum Brilliance doing amazing things with quantum diamonds. That's a whole other conversation. But we have a really great ecosystem of companies doing all sorts of things, even down to sort of quantum sensing as well. which have sort of lots of defense applications. So yeah, it's amazing to think we have such a vibrant ecosystem here in Australia.
Jacinta Bola, tell me about some tech that has brought you joy this week.
So I have been spending much too much time on Discord. I've been playing this very nerdy game where, you know, a bunch of people will get together and pretend to do little battles and things with all of our little troops. So that's what I've been doing with all of my spare time. And I
Excellent.
Love it.
It sounds like a pretty decent way to spend your spare time, honestly. Justin Hendry, tell me about some tech that's brought you joy this week, please.
Yeah, so I did an interview the other day with a local AI company, basically. They've built a sovereign platform, AI platform, and enjoyed sort of putting that through its paces. And you know, I think it's great because you know everyone uses ChatGPT or Claude or any of the major sort of US models. So I think it's really good to step outside of that and to try something that is built here, especially after we've seen, what we've seen with Anthropic removing access to some of their top models, or, that kind of stuff potentially is very damaging in the future if we rely solely on those kinds of platforms. So, yeah, it was great to use an Australian model.
Fantastic. So, yeah, but being able to play with a model that has an Australian bias as opposed to someone else's bias. Jacinta, thank you so much for joining us for Download This Show. Where can people find you and your work?
If you liked this, please check out Dead and Alive. It's a science fiction podcast, and I'm really proud of it. I'm really happy with how it came out, and I hope everybody likes it as well. And if you don't like it, don't let me know.
Five stars only.
Thank you. Yes, that's what I'm hoping for.
Justin, thank you for joining us once again. Where can people find you and your work?
Yeah, innovationoz.com, writing there most days. So, yeah, that's it.
Fantastic. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
And now for some more tech news from the week that was. In case you missed it, Samsung has launched three new folding phones, including a wider Fold 8 model built for watching video alongside an updated premium Ultra and its usual flip phone. Prices have risen on two of the three models, pushed up by a global shortage of memory chips, the components that store data inside a phone. Analysts are expecting Samsung's mobile division to post its first ever quarterly loss as a result. The launch is coming ahead of an expected rival folding phone from Apple. A 15-year-old has withdrawn his lawsuit against Meta days before it was due to go to trial in Los Angeles. He's accused the Instagram and Facebook owner of contributing to depression and anxiety he developed after starting social media at age 8. His lawyers say he's chosen to focus on therapy and recovery rather than a lengthy trial. The two other companies he sued, Google's YouTube and ByteDance's TikTok, had already settled. And that's all for this week. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. We do love hearing all of your thoughts and your feedback, so send them over. Download This Show at abc.net.au is where you can email me, or you can slide into my DMs on Instagram at Ray Johnston. Big thanks to my producer, Jesse Kay. This episode was produced on the lands of the Gadigal, Burramuttigal, Darug, Gundungra and Wurundjeri peoples. I'm Ray Johnston, and you've been listening to Download This Show.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.